think that wasn't too sudden. I think we got everybody. Okay. 102 here. Today's date is the 13th of February. We have before us today three bills that were on the schedule. HB 1, requirements for driver's license. We have HB 69, exemption from firearm for firearms and federal regulation from federal regulations. HB 73, which is the governor's bill on crime against for child abuse and neglect. And then if we get a chance, we'll go to bills previously heard and HB 83. That's four bills. I would like to see us, my hope is that we can move the first two, the 1 and 69. We have with us today Representative Charisse Millett and Representative Neil Foster and Representative Bob Lynn and myself, Chair, Representative Wes Keller. And we probably will be joined shortly by a few others, but I want to press on, so we'll go right to the first bill up. We've been given version uniform, and that's the version that we will be presented. You're going to have your staff introduce.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make an opening statement, and then do you want to do it from here, or do you want me to go down there?
No, you can stay right there, and we'll put your staff there. So, with that, Representative Lynn, if you would go ahead and make your opening statement.
I thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for considering this bill today. It's a very simple, basically one paragraph bill. I think it's a common sense bill. It merely says that the Department of Motor Vehicles, the DMV, is able to issue a driver's license for less than 5 years. Issue a driver's license for less than 5 years, nothing more, nothing less. The situation today, for example, is that somebody can wander into the DMV with a visa that expires in 2 weeks and get a driver's license for 5 years, and I don't think that makes common sense. If for some reason their visa or whatever legal presence document they have is indefinite, then the state can issue a driver's license for 1 year with automatic renewal at no additional cost to the applicant. And this has nothing to do with immigration whatsoever. The DMV is perfectly capable of handling everything that's required here. And my staff is here to help us go through the bill if there are any questions. And then we have a list of frequently asked questions which may answer some of your concerns. And so I'd like to introduce my staff, Forrest Wolf. He's the prime worker on this bill for me.
Through the chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, staff for Representative Bob Lynn. Determining how long a foreign national is legally allowed to stay in the United States is the purview of the Department of Homeland Security, not the state of Alaska. We should not be issuing official or legal documentation that outlasts a person's legal presence in the U.S. House Bill 1 simply enables the DMV to issue a driver's license for less than 5 years so that a visitor's license expires at the same time as their visa or other authorized length of stay document. This bill reflects what is considered best practice by the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. Currently, 36 other states, as well as the District of Columbia, have these similar policies in statute or regulation. Alaska DMV already requires a new applicant for a driver's license to prove legal presence, as is the case in all but four other states. House Bill 1 merely fine-tunes our existing law to ensure that a driver's license reflects the documentation that is currently submitted to the DMV. This bill also allows an international visitor to renew their license without any additional fee if their visa or legal presence document is extended for a period of up to 5 years. This is the same length of time as it is for nearly all Alaskans. These renewals can be done in person, by mail, and hopefully soon via the internet. This ensures these visitors won't be incurring any extra fees that other Alaskans are not. In the rare instance a visitor has a provisional, pending, or other indefinite length of stay, they will renew their licenses every year, again with no additional fees. We wanted this legislation to be as simple as possible. That's why we specifically left out state ID cards from the bill. The DMV already has the authority to issue state ID cards for less than 5 years. It does not have the same authority for driver's licenses. Once again, this bill does not change how people currently obtain a driver's license. The documentation requirements and verification procedures currently in use will remain in place. Also, there is no requirement in this bill that people present any immigration documentation as proof of ID when applying for a driver's license. However, if a person does use these documents, then the DMV will consider the expiration date. This bill is essentially the same version of a bill that passed the House last session by a vote of 33-2 with 5 excused absences. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have as best I can. Here with me is Deputy Attorney General Rick Sabodny. Online, I also have the Director of DMV, Amy Erickson, and her Deputy Director, Shelly Malott, and then Agent Dean Wasson of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and finally Kathleen Strasbaugh from Legislative Legal Services, available for presentations and questions as well. Thank you.
That covers any questions for the sponsor or the sponsor staff. Yeah, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I had the opportunity to meet with the sponsor of this legislation. I appreciate that, and I just wanted to, for the record, my concerns that it could potentially affect rural Alaska. It doesn't appear that that would be the case, and I just wanted to maybe get another elaboration on that, if you could.
Right. Well, yeah, this isn't going to negatively affect rural Alaska any more than it's going to affect anyone else in the state. It doesn't change any of the existing policies on citizens, Alaskan citizens, and U.S. residents already. So,
when you respond, if you would, try to give your name first, just to kind of keep some order. But I also wanted to acknowledge Representative Grunberg. He got here about 1:04. He never missed any of the testimony, so I mean, he's been with us. So didn't want that to go. But Representative North.
Thank you. One of my constituents is actually had put some testimony, and I think you guys all got the email from Margaret Stock. I rely on her pretty heavily for some advice on citizenship and illegal alien status, and she's come up with a list of maybe six questions that we should probably wade through and get some background on. One of the things that she brings up is a similar bill, and full disclosure, I'm a co-sponsor of the bill, but one of the things she brings up, which I wasn't aware of, was that New Hampshire attempted the same policy and was sued by a Roman Catholic nun, or someone sued them and was forced to change its policy and then had to pay the attorney's fees and compensation because the bill, you know, went too far, and the federal constitution, it violated the federal constitution and also violated New Hampshire's constitution. So my question is, have we looked at other states to see if we've made sure that we're not setting ourselves up for increased litigation, and two, that we've made the process so that DMV can actually enforce the law that we're asking them to enforce? Because she brings up some really good points about, you know, there's so many different types of workers in the state of Alaska. They've got different people with different visas. So if you had a person that was coming up to commercial fish or coming up to work on a processor, that every time they left and came back, they would have to, because their work designation was only for 6 weeks, but they were coming back 3 weeks later to work on the same processor, according to her, she's an attorney, she thinks that that person would have to render their license after 6 weeks and then come back 3 weeks later and get their license again. So there's a migrant worker issue that she brings up, which just because I have some background in fishing, I could see where that would be a problem. And then she also talks about the Canadian workers, because of our NAFTA treaty, that they, if they went home, had a driver's license in Alaska, and they went home for a vacation for at least, you know, even one day, when they would have to come back and get a new driver's license again after their short vacation back in Canada. So those are just questions, and I think you have her list of questions here. And so I was hoping that we could take some time and go through what she brings up. I mean, she's an expert in immigration, and
well,
I trust her opinion, so I would like to...
Representative Wynn, did you want to respond?
Just briefly. I had a long conversation with this lady on the phone. I thought I addressed some of these concerns, but we do have the director of DMV is going to be able to respond to some of that. We also have, I believe, somebody from ICE is going to be here, as well as the legal assistant, and I Rick Savatny's out there also. I think they're probably better qualified to answer some of this. But this changes, the only thing it changes is just a DMV's ability to issue the license for less than 5 years. Maybe my staff could expand on that.
Well,
for the record,
Amy, are you online to perhaps maybe
for the record?
For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, staff to Representative Bob Lynn. Sorry.
Before Amy responds, the representative Ledoux has joined us and Representative Pruitt. So welcome, Amy. Are you online? And have you been hearing the conversation?
I have, Mr. Chair. This is Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles.
And you have a copy of the questions that were raised by Representative Millett?
I do. I haven't read through every single one, but DMV feels confident that none of our practices will change. Our staff is trained on documents, and they deal with these documents on a daily basis, and we don't feel like it would change any of our practices now.
Thank you, Amy. And we'll stop there unless somebody has a question directly for Amy, and then when Department of Law comes up, they can respond as they will. And I just wanted to ask, though, if there's anything the drafter wanted to add. Kathleen?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're real weak. If you could get close to the mic.
Yes, this is Kathleen Strasbaugh.
Have you been hearing the questions that came up, and what is your response?
Yes, I have not read that New Hampshire case, but I've been told about it, and I was under the impression that in the New Hampshire case, the state had actually denied a license rather than conducted the issuance of the license in the manner contemplated by the bill. I am not aware of any challenges to the other 35 states' laws that were successful. Most of the litigation has been around refusing to grant the license or other valuable benefits to otherwise legal aliens.
Okay, thank you. Before we bring the Department of Law up, is there any other questions you want to put on the record, Representative Greenberg?
Just for the record, I know Margaret Stock, and she's one of two or three real experts in the field of immigration law practice in the state. She is a former professor at West Point, and she specializes in this area. I would request that she be invited to testify and be able to put on the record her concerns and answer any questions.
Representative Greenberg, she has submitted thorough in writing. You have that in front of you, her concerns? Okay, thank you. She is not online, and I would like to, if we can mostly answer the questions, I'd like to see us move the bill today. And if we can't, you know, then if there's something you feel like is not addressed, then let us know, and we will make that determination. Not trying to be rammy. But any other questions for the staff? Or for Representative Lynn. Yes, Representative Rupert.
With that, I can see this is to deal with only one very specific issue, but the title is much broader. And if we're going to move the bill, I would think we should probably narrow the title to cover this issue. Otherwise, it could come back Christmas tree with a bunch of things that some of us might like.
Representative Greenberg, I think that's a very good suggestion. We can do that.
And I do have one other thing.
And in response to that, I have no problem with tidying up the title.
Thanks. I think, recalling back when we dealt with this subject several times over the last years, I'm just talking generally. Driver's license. I'm not talking about this specific thing. One of the issues was, and I'm looking at Representative Foster here, the difficulty people in other parts of the state where there are no DMV offices might have if they had to renew driver's license on a fairly frequent basis. It's nothing that's in the bill itself. It's the practical problems that may cause. And you won't find it from the face of the bill, but You know, I think you'd have to talk to your people, but I think some people might very well find this is going to be difficult for them to do.
So, Representative Foster, did you want to add to your earlier comment? Or
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From what I understand, the requirement to renew would be no different than the requirement to renew if you're a U.S. citizen and having to renew each 5 years. And so for a person who had a visa and needed to renew, that would be the same as any other person. And I understand that there might be, you know, the ability to, whether it's doing a mail-in renewal and internet and so forth. And so I think from that standpoint, my concerns were alleviated. But I don't know if maybe, you could add to that.
Through the chair, Representative Foster. For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, Representative Staff Representative Boblin, you're correct in your line of thinking. So I'll just say you're correct. Yes.
Rick, do you mind coming up? Or while the sponsor is still there, I know you multitask well, so I'm sure you heard the questions, and if you have something to add to our discussion, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Rick Sabatier. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. This is a little bit out of my area of expertise. The Department of Law, one of the Civil Division attorneys, looked at the bill and found no constitutional problems with the bill. In regards, I don't have the list of questions, but I was looking here to try to find the answer to one of them. My recollection of the law, and I hope maybe the people from DMV can correct me if I have this wrong, but actually I think there's a licensing requirement of being in the state 10 days and employed to get a driver's license. So I think that's probably substantially more restrictive than, if that's still the law, I know it used to be the law, if that's still the law, I think that, that's an issue that would affect the fishers who come up and are on short time working on fishing boats. But I know it used to be the law. DMV may have got that changed over time.
Any questions? Amy, did you hear that? Do you have anything to add? Amy Erickson from DMV.
Mr. Chairman, this is Amy Erickson. I believe the term is 30 days to be in state.
Okay.
And not.
Okay. Thank you.
They're more liberal than they used to be.
Seeing no other questions right now, we can always call the sponsor staff and Department of Law back up. So, thank you. And did you have something?
I do.
Representative Millett.
Just a comment. This is the only committee referral for this bill. And so I guess...
No.
Is it going...
West State.
This is the second committee.
Oh, the second, yeah. Well, I guess in light of getting this email from, like Representative Groomberg said, from someone who's spent all her life on immigration, I know we want to move the bill, but I would be uncomfortable moving it until we got some more responses from, and I had an opportunity to talk to Ms. Stock about some of her concerns. I mean, they seem valid, and that would be my only request.
Representative Millett, I will respect that. We will not do it. I would just ask that you get the answers. Well, I would point out, if it makes any difference, that as I read the bill, the word visa is not in there. The guidelines for determination of authorized stay is real general and broad and easy, and that's why I have no problem. But
okay.
Yeah. But I will ask you to confirm again later that you'd like a little more time. So, Representative Foster.
Just one quick question, and that is, for my district, House District 39, I believe that there are very, very few people that this would impact. For the folks that are out in the villages, Very few of them have visas. Most people are U.S. citizens, and therefore this is not going to impact them. And I think, you know, I'm thinking about Wales or Shishmaref or Fort Yukon or Hoosley or Hughes. I don't think there are many visas out in the villages. But I'm just curious, when you do come back, I don't know if it's possible to find out how many, you know, visas or folks would be affected in the state. You know, I'm suspecting it's probably more, you know, the fishermen or maybe in some of the urban areas. But, you know, I kind of just want to point out, I think it's very, very minimal in rural Alaska. It's not going to be an impact for us. So, thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Just in response to Representative Foster's comment, Ms. Stock points out that there's a study, recent study, or the Center for Migration Studies, whatever that is, in February 2013, it says that Alaska's unauthorized immigrant population is less than 5,000.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Woodward.
My ever-vigilant staff has provided a quick statutory update here, and I didn't mark it up, but if the members would look at the bottom of this page, AS 28.15.101C, the very bottom of the page, it says that a driver's license may be renewed by mail if the licensee completes the requirements of sub A, but not if, number one, the most recent renewal of the applicant's license was by mail, or if they're at least 69. And I know there's several on this committee looking at the sponsor and myself who grudgingly meet that requirement. So we couldn't do it. But I'm talking about primarily the first one. So you've at least got to go in person every other time you renew your driver's license. That's current law.
Interesting.
I thank my staff.
Yeah. Thank you, Forrest. Let's go online. We have several that want to testify. Matthew Kerr, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Do you have testimony for us on HB 1?
Yes, I do.
Go for it. Identify yourself for the record and tell who you represent, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Matthew Kerr, and I'm here representing my own views as a Alaskan resident. I've testified in many previous sessions on bills similar to this one. I am happy that it has improved, but the basic issue hasn't changed. This bill would needlessly bloat our bureaucracy, slow down processing at the DMV, and cause a lot of trouble to people who are following the law, all to solve a problem that doesn't exist here. The existing DMV regulations do not allow an illegal immigrant to obtain a driver's license, and so please take a second to consider that. This has been true for quite some time. In addition, our DMV has no problem referring suspected illegal immigrants to ICE. And what precisely is the legislative goal of limiting the validity of a driver's license? If it's not an immigration issue, then what type of driving violation would a person have incurred to justify limiting their license's validity? Would the state prefer that people instead use their foreign driver's licenses to bypass our state's licensing requirements, which is completely permissible under the law? And even under the existing rules, I've personally seen legal individuals be denied a driver's license at the main DMV office, even when they presented complete and correct documentation. One friend of mine ended up going DMV shopping to solve this issue. The period of legal presence in the United States is a moving target that can change on a daily or weekly basis for many individuals, often faster than written documentation can arrive. When the DMV cannot reliably determine if someone is legally present in the first place, I can't imagine how many more mistakes and bureaucratic headaches this bill would cause. And over the past few sessions, it's appeared to me that the conception of this bill comes from a simplified and utopian view of U.S. immigration law and fails to comprehend what an expensive bureaucratic mess this bill will inspire. Basically, I support smaller and more efficient governments. I support legislative ideas that solve our problems instead of causing them. I support the drivers sharing the road with me having passed our examination requirements. And finally, I don't support punishing people who are legally present in the United States. And that is why I oppose this bill.
Thank you, Matthew. Dean Lawson, are you online? Homeland Security?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
You've been listening to our discussion. If you have anything to add, you're sure welcome to.
Yes, indeed I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Lynn, for having me on today. First of all, I'd like to say that although I do not have the high education that Ms. Margaret Stock has, that I have been working in the field of immigration enforcement for over 15 years and have quite a bit of experience day-to-day on that factor, and that if any legislators would like to ask me any specific questions about Ms. Stock's letter that she presented, I will be more than happy to answer any specific questions on any issues that she may have raised. First of all, though, I would like to say that if you read her letter, there is an assumption that the future status of an individual in the United States may change and that they may continue to be able to remain in the United States. And that is true in some cases. However, in all cases, the assumption has to be made that when their legal presence in the United States is over, that they are to leave and not return until they're issued some other type of documentation. So although their legal status may end up changing, we have to assume that it's not going to change, and that if another document is issued extending their stay in the United States legally, that it should be handled at that time. The second thing that I would like to say just after reading the Ms. Stock's letter is that she brings up some very unique classes of individuals, not all of whom need driver's license or have ever applied for a driver's license, and it makes, she's pointing out some very specific instances where in fact an individual may be required to obtain a driver's license more often than once a year, but the chances that they actually have one now or need one in the future is almost infinitesimal when you're talking about those folks. That if you're talking about their need to drive in the state of Alaska, and then the last comment that I would like to make before I take any questions is that I do believe, as an individual who's charged with the enforcement of immigration law in the United States, and also a citizen of the state of Alaska in the United States, that this is just a common sense piece of legislation. The DMV has already been testified is already required to verify that an individual has to be in the country legally, and with my dealings with the DMV on a day-to-day basis, it doesn't seem to me like this would cause them any greater hardship to enforce than what they already do. And if there's no cost option, I don't see where it becomes an issue for those individuals. So that said, please feel free to ask me specific questions about visa categories that are in Ms. Stock's letter or any other questions that you have that you believe that my expertise might be helpful to shine some light on.
Representative Greenberg has a question.
Thank you. I'm sorry, did I get your name? Your last name is Mr. Lawson?
It's Lawson, sir. Wausson.
Mr. Lawson, are you with the Department of Homeland Security?
Yes, that's correct. I'm a supervisory special agent with Homeland Security Investigations.
That's in Anchorage?
That's correct.
And are you speaking for the department or just your own personal views?
I'm speaking for my own personal views.
Does the Department of Homeland Security have any position on this bill?
If they do, I'm not aware of it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean. I'm quite sure you will be contacted by Representative Millett or my staff, so we can
put these questions behind us that have come up, and the one that Representative Foster raised. One last testifier, and then we'll move on to the other bill. Jeff Landfield, are you on listing, and do you have a comment?
Yeah.
Identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent, and go ahead.
My name is Jeff Landfield. I'm a represent myself. I'm just a Anchorage resident, Alaska resident.
Give us your testimony.
Okay, I just wanted to echo some of the previous statements. I'm not really sure what this bill aims to solve. I don't really think we have a problem, and I do believe it would, you know, massively increase bureaucracy, and I think the push would be for less bureaucracy and not more. You guys have cited visas. I've personally been to the DMV, as one of the previous callers said, with somebody with an expired visa who was here as a student, who was here legally, and the DMV person could not understand that. It ended up being a big fiasco. And there's plenty of other issues, federal issues. I mean, people could be tax cheats or have gun violations, and we could deny them driver's licenses. But when you say it's not an immigration bill, I think it has everything to do with immigration. I just don't think the DMV is equipped to deal with this very complex matter. I happen to have a lot of friends who are here legally, who are immigrants from different countries with different statuses, and I think you have to be some kind of, you know, expert. I think this immigration was compared to King Minos's labyrinth by some judges. So again, I think the push should be for not more bureaucracy, but less bureaucracy. I don't think really any problem exists right now. So I think it would be very expensive. I don't know if there's been a cost-benefit analysis done, but I can't imagine it would be cheaper.
Thank you, Jeff. I don't see any questions for you at this time. I was just looking. We have our fiscal analysis shows a zero impact, so you know.
There's been a law firm in Colorado that has one person specifically designed to go to the DMV. They passed a similar bill with foreigners, non-immigrants, to basically prove who they are. And they're having to pay for that, the individuals, not the state. So it's enacting a pretty heavy burden on individuals who are here legally who need a license, who come here and they want to work. And that's been documented in Colorado. It's a very similar bill.
Representative Wynn?
Yes, sir. Thank you for testifying today. I just point out, again, this bill has nothing to do with immigration. I just used visa as an example. Visa means visitor. I've used a visa, gone to several different countries with a visa. It didn't mean I was immigrating there. And it's simply best practices adopted by several other different states. And again, we're not trying to establish legal presence. We're just trying to fix it so the DMV can match the duration of the driver's license to whatever date is on the document that they show. Whatever document they show at the DMV is what they're going to look at. The license is going to look exactly the same except for the expiration date.
Jeff, did you have a response to that you want to make?
I would say there are several non-immigrant visa categories that the visa could be expired and the person could be there perfectly legally. You can apply for, I think, the Treaty National Visa. You can apply for an extension and you get an automatic 240-day extension. So the visa's expired, the person's here legally. You would have to know that in order to, and there's hundreds of other examples like that where you have to know that. It's not, you don't have some piece of paper someone gives you to say, oh, hi, I'm legal. Well, I'm here in status. You'd have to have an attorney or somebody who's an expert in the field be able to go to statute, or some countries have exceptions. They post updates on the website and they say, you know, Burundi or Brunei has a new exception for individuals who are here. So, I mean, this is going to make a problem. It maybe not every day, but it'll make problems for people, and it already has in other states.
Well, thank you for your testimony. What we do is close public testimony at this time. We can always open it again. And we have plenty to cogitate on here, and I think we'll be able to answer the questions and proceed. Did I miss a question, Representative Adu? I'd like to close this one down right now and get to the next bill.
I guess I'll make it the next time around.
Thank you. Yeah, because we'll have the bill before us again.
Mr. Chair, so just in preparation for the next time, if we can make, the staff can make sure that different people who've testified, have copies of Ms. Stock's letter and vice versa, then we can ask questions and they'll be prepared to explore the stuff that we've already received in writing. That was what my interest is.
Thank you for your advice. Okay, so we'll put this bill aside right now and move on to HB 69.
This is the one.
I couldn't hear what you said.
So, before you proceed, Mr. Sponsor, Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to withdraw my motion for CS for House Bill number 69, version N, and put before the committee the same bill would be version O.
See no objection. Version O is a working copy. Go ahead. Representative Chenault, but can you identify yourself for the record and tell us everything you need to know?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, Representative Chenault, I represent most of the Kenai Peninsula. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll let my staff go through, but there were a couple of changes from the N version to the O version, and they addressed a number of issues, one dealing with taxation and one dealing with retroactivity. So, Mr. Chairman, my staff will explain what the changes were, and hopefully those answered any questions that the committee members had.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tom Wright, staff to Speaker Chenault. The changes from the N version, as the Speaker pointed out, we deleted taxing any firearm or its ammunition that might have had an effect on Pittman-Robertson funds, which fund a number of programs within this state. So the chairman, with his eagle eye, caught that, and we removed it. The other two sections were in Section 5, we removed the retroactive date, and in Section 6, we deleted the retroactive date. Those are the changes that were incorporated into the O version, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
Before we pass on from this, can you, Mr. Wright, tell us where the very first change, the taxing language, was?
If you look at the N version, Mr. Chairman, and go to page 1, line 13, the end of that sentence where it says taxing any firearm or its ammunition.
I see that went out. I see. I don't maintain an objection. I didn't say I had an objection, but no. For the record, I would, just for discussion, and I would
withdraw
at this point.
Okay, great. So, you have an objection. Any other questions for the sponsor or the sponsor staff?
Just so my record is.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. Looking on the N version on page 3, or page 4, it looks like the language that was deleted there is on lines 5 and 6, just on line 5, the phrase that was removed is, quote, that is adopted on or after the effective date of effort, this section, and then section 6, the retroactivity. I think that's, no, that's not.
Mr. Chairman, again, going back to the N version, I know we removed the motion to adopt that version, but the retroactive change occurs on page 3, line 27, where it says on or after January 1st, 2013. Now it's on or after the effective date of this legislation.
Oh, I see.
And then on page 4, line 9 and 10, the retroactivity clause was removed or deleted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Greenberg?
It looks like you also removed the language I mentioned on page 4, line 5. So I think that was also removed. But I didn't catch the other thing, but I see what you're talking about. Say again?
It's probably just conforming language.
Yeah, right. Term. Right.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. I think it's...
It was all removed.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that language was in the N version. with a retroactive, or not a retroactive date. That version was in the end version. Now it's in the O version. Okay. If that makes sense, Mr. Chairman.
I see no other questions at this time, so thank you, and let's go to public testimony. Lynn Willis, are you online?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please give us your testimony.
My name is Lynn Willis. I'm from Eagle River, and I'm representing myself. I oppose this legislation. I oppose the concept of it. I don't care if we were talking about M1911s or Model 88 Winchesters or AR-15s, or Begonias for that matter. This legislation is not a petition or request for consideration from the federal government. This is creates law which would make felons out of law-abiding Alaskans by use of the language. A federal statute is unenforceable in this state. An official agent employee of the federal government who enforces a federal statute that is unenforceable is guilty of a felony. How would the 20 sponsors of this bill feel if the municipality of Anchorage declared state law as unenforceable and declared state legislators to be criminal if they attempted to create and enforce state law in Anchorage? Another thing, no federal law is created in Alaska. So will you make outlaws out of our federal delegation for creating unenforceable law? I understand this action is known as constitutional nullification. Over 600,000 Americans died between 1861 and 1865 in the World Rebellion, caused by the efforts of the southern states to nullify the Constitution of the United States. That experience should weigh on your minds, along with the multiple federal court rulings that don't uphold this idea. I don't think the federal government, even in 2013, is going to entertain constitutional nullification of the punishment of federal employees for enforcing federal law, whether it relates to firearms or any other subject. I served 22 years as a member of the Alaska National Guard as a federal civil servant and as an active duty member. I served with federal marshals, federal civil service employees, as well as state troopers and Anchorage police officers. We were all guardsmen. What would you have us do under the concept of this bill? Arrest each other? I said, this upsets me. I have submitted written testimony opposing this bill. If you don't believe in an indivisible republic, why would you pledge allegiance to it and swear an oath to its constitution if you support state law that would invalidate that indivisible republic's legally created laws and make criminals out of its agents for enforcing those laws in Alaska? But finally, I'll conclude. I want you to move this bill. I want this bill to go to the House of Representatives so that every Alaska federal employee can look up and see that big green Y and understand how he's subject to be treated by the Alaska legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Anyone in the room that would like to testify on this bill? Anyone else online? Okay, we'll close public testimony at this time. The bill is forward to committee for discussion.
Or action.
I'd like to say that, just if I, I'm a co-sponsor of the bill, just to declare where I'm coming from, but the issues before us in this bill are a regular feature of U.S. history. It goes way back, and it has to do with the definition of the, of the nation. And Mr. Willis made a reference to the Civil War and changing all that, and not true. I mean, the states existed before the Constitution. The U.S. existed before the Constitution. It was they're both independent. Has been commented on in the Supreme Court in many cases after the Civil War about the fact that the state has its own rights and sovereignty, and there's just a large discussion there. But it just I raise my right hand to uphold both the U.S. Constitution and the state constitution. When I see a bill like this, I'm very positive on it because it calls out the things that may threaten the U.S. Constitution that I have sworn to uphold. So, anyway, that's Representative Winberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. this is actually something that is more than an academic exercise. In the 1980s, a state legislator was arrested for possessing a machine gun in the state capitol. and that was sort of an ad hoc attempt at nullification. And the legislator was ultimately acquitted. But the feds don't blink at this. They will enforce federal law, and if people attempt to rely on this, they may find themselves facing a federal jury. And I'm very loath to subject any of my people to that. You know, they say that ignorance of the law is no excuse. There may be some people who do it out of ignorance, but they may find themselves going to jail for a long time. And I think that that's the first reason I'm going to vote no. And the second is because it is unconstitutional. And third, because it's not enforceable. And if we litigate it, we're going to spend more money trying to make a political statement. And and trying to do it at the cost to the taxpayer and at the fact that we may be seriously misleading people who should not be misled. I don't like the fact that the federal government is attempting to encroach on states' rights in this area, but this is not the way to do it. The way to do it is to try to change federal law if you can. Otherwise, we're part of the United States, and we must live by their rules, just as some of their rules protect us. I'm not going to oppose the movement of the bill, but I can't support it, not because I don't support the sentiment, but because I believe it's unconstitutional and unenforceable, and I have to live with that.
Any other comments? Reverend Ledoux.
I think sometimes statements by themselves are important. And if you look at the marijuana legislation being passed by Citizens Initiative around the country, you see that sometimes the feds do blink.
I just can't help myself. This is a favorite topic of mine, and I think that that has been documented over time. The one of my favorite stories is Glover in Wisconsin. I don't know if you've read it or not, but we had the Fugitive Slave Act that the Congress passed, and basically it was you have to return the slave to his owner, irregardless of state lines. And there was a guy named Glover in Wisconsin that they caught, and they wanted to haul back, and he escaped to Canada. But my point is, the state of Wisconsin, the state Supreme Court and the legislature defied the Supreme Court of the United States, you know, and it was very embarrassing for the federal government. And I appreciate Representative Grunberg's comment that this is very serious stuff. You're talking jail, you know, and all those things that went on. But this went back and forth for 4 or 5 years before it was finally died down. And that goes back to your point. In the end, the bottom line is, if there's an unconstitutional law and the state refuses to enforce it, ultimately, that's our choice. It may be very expensive, like you said. Any other comments?
And I suppose the example I gave may be in effect the ultimate nullification of federal law when that legislator was acquitted. But it took him a lot of money, and the federal government a lot of money to get to that point. And I've said what I've said, but I just think nullification can come in various forms. This is not a closing argument to the jury, although I know how you folks would vote if I made that argument to you. We'd see another acquittal.
And we could have a good time the rest of the day.
What's the level as long as we're not in the dock.
What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Vice Chair, you want to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Scoot over here, please. It would be my pleasure to motion to move CS for House Bill number, get my glasses on here so we move the right bill here, House Bill number 69, 28-LS0290/O from this committee with individual recommendations.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves. If you would attach the fiscal note.
And fiscal note's attached.
Okay. Testimony from, first of all, from prosecution, Department of Law. Then we had testimony from defense, public defender, and the Office of Public Advocacy. And there's been, points brought out that I don't have, that we're not going to itemize, but the Department of Law was listening in, of course, on the last hearing, and they're here to clarify some of the things that were out there while we're processing this bill. We'll take your thoughts into consideration. So if you would, identify yourself for the record and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Sabodny. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and I'm here to speak on in relationship to the last meeting you had on this bill. And in part, my comments are going to be in response to the Public Defender's Office and the ACLU, but more generally where I saw, or I thought I saw, issues of some confusion either from the people testifying or the members of the committee. So if I get way too much in the weeds, just give me a thumbs down and I'll move on, okay? I wanted to talk first about sections 1, 20, 21, and those are the sections of the bill that the lawyers love because it deals with a case, Yako Collins. But I think some history, and it seeks to overturn the decision of the Court of Appeals. Since you last heard testimony on this, the Alaska Supreme Court has granted the state's petition to review the case. That doesn't mean it should come out of this bill, because that decision is going to take 2 years. I mean, we haven't even started the briefing process. It was last Friday that we got notice that they accepted the case for review. But let me give you kind of the background of this. In the mid-70s, the then Chief Justice Jay Rabinowitz gave a State of the Judiciary speech to the legislature. And in part, he talked about the disparity in sentencing between Caucasians and non-Caucasians in the state of Alaska. At the same time that in that same time frame, the legislature had established a Criminal Code Revision Commission, and that commission took Chief Justice Rabinowitz's remarks and tried to figure out a method of sentencing people that would eliminate that disparity. And what they came up with was presumptive sentencing. I don't mean they made it out of whole cloth. Other states that had presumptive sentencing at that time, but not a whole lot of them. And what presumptive sentencing is that the legislature says what presumably is the correct sentence for a particular crime. You, in 1978, passed not any one of you, I don't think, but actually, I was here in 1978.
But I ain't that old.
In 1978, passed a bill that established presumptive sentencing in this case. And the idea is that for both as a result of the nature of the crime, and your criminal record, that you could look at a matrix and decide what the correct presumptive sentence would be. So, for example, a second degree burglar for a third felony offense, the presumptively correct sentence at that time, the legislature said, was 3 years. They said, wait a minute, though. I mean, we just can't do it on your criminal record and your and the nature of the crime. There are going to be some crimes that are extraordinarily aggravated, and then maybe you should get the maximum, which was at that time 5 years for the second degree burglary, or maybe you should get no jail time. But we are going to articulate
the factors that are going to up that sentence or decrease the sentence. And we call those in our, statutes aggravating factors and mitigating factors. And if I can do this off the top of my head, 1255, 155C for aggravators and D for mitigating factors. So when a court goes to sentence somebody, they say, well, there is this aggravating factor. I shouldn't deviate from what the legislature said unless this is an appropriate aggravating factor, or here's this mitigating factor. I shouldn't reduce the sentence from what the legislature said unless there's a good reason to do it. So we had these aggravators and mitigating factors. They're in statutes. They're there. You last year passed a mitigating factor that said that sentences from these ranges for the presumptive sentence should be reduced if somebody there's fetal alcohol spectrum disorder with the person who committed the crime. So, I mean, these are dynamic. They're changing from year to year. Their aggravators are added, mitigators are added. As a result of a Supreme Court case in the early 2000s, some of you were here for that, the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Blakely basically kind of changed the rules of our presumptive sentencing scheme and said some things had to be tried to the jury. And the legis that weren't before, these aggravating factors. The legislature responded to that by, instead of having, my burglary example, a presumptively correct sentence of 3 years, it would be a range. So it could be two to four years, and then the state would have to come to a jury and prove those aggravating factors. I'm getting too in the weeds, I can tell you. So we had so on top of all that, there was this safeguard, and this safeguard is where this Yako Collins decision comes in. The legislature said, look, if this scheme is not working, scheme sounds pejorative, if this system is not working, we're going to have a safety valve, and we're going to call that a three-judge panel. And you can get a case out of this system to a three-judge panel if one or two things exist. Whether it's if the defendant can show that there would be manifest injustice to go with the scheme that the legislature passed in 1978, took effect in 1980. That's one way. And the other way is it would be unjustifiable to impose the presumptive sentence if there was some non-statutory mitigating factor, something that the legislature didn't think to put in those mitigating factors. And here comes, now we're getting, jumping forward, 2006. In 2006, the legislature changed the presumptive ranges for sexual offenses. And when it did that, I know I'm not supposed to speak the name of the other body, but the other body made some findings of fact. Well, I'm kind of blaming it on them, so I thought it'd be okay. They made some findings of fact, or some legislative findings that went along with the legislation. And those findings were that sexual felonies are difficult to treat. They are often committed by people who are repeat offenders. That there are many people who are victimized, especially between the ages of 12 and 16, and that young girls, that young victims, especially young girls, are very detrimentally affected by being sexually abused. Okay, that's what the legislature did. This Yako Collins case two judges to one judge, said, well, the legislature must have meant that there's some non-statutory mitigating factors because of these findings of fact. For example, that these offenses are often committed by people who are repeat offenders. So they said, well, we think the legislature must have meant that when they said that, that if the person doesn't have any other sexual offenses, that that ought to be a mitigating factor. And they said that that because the legislature found that sex offenders are difficult to treat, that was another one of the findings, that people who, one of the mitigating factors is if there's very good prospects for rehabilitation. Well, when the legislature said these people are difficult to treat, they must have meant to change that mitigating factor to something less than good, extraordinary prospects for rehabilitation. That's why you get this weird language that's in the bill that if you have that you can't go to a three-judge panel because we're changing the rules to say you have to have something more than mediocre prospects for rehabilitation, or that the legislature didn't make a finding that said that these people often have a lot of victims with the idea that these cases should go outside of the presumptive sentencing model that the legislature established. So that's really kind of in a nutshell what's out there. It's I'm reminded of the bill that you just the bill that you just passed. It's kind of judicial findings, judicial made law here there is nothing in the legislative record in 2006 to suggest that the legislature was trying to create non-statutory mitigating factors. You know how to do it if you want to do it. You could have just made it. If that's what the idea was, they would have just normally been mitigating factors. So I'm going to move on to a different section.
Thank you. That was very helpful to me. Thank you. But Representative Miller has a question.
Mr. Shimani, so what you're saying is that the courts interpreted it as a lowering the standard to on sentencing, the legislative intent was that if there's these mitigating factors, then our intent was to give a broader range and lower the standard for sentencing?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I don't know whether you'd say lower the standards. It's opened a different door. If you had extraordinary prospects for rehabilitation, that was a door that was already open. That could take you out of this scheme. But they opened this other door. If it's a sex offense, and the legislature in 2006 upped the level of offenses, we're opening a door to say that you can use the mitigating factor of less than extraordinary prospects for rehabilitation. I may just be saying it in a different way than you are there. I think we're close.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, before you proceed, I want to tell the committee that ACLU Jeffrey Minton is online to answer any questions too that may come up. Please proceed.
During the last hearing, an issue arose regarding to Section 16, Section 13, and Section 13 is known as the Rape Shield Statute, and it says that the sexual conduct of a victim of a sexual offense, that their prior sexual history, as a general rule, shouldn't be admissible at trial. And the question was raised by one of the members of the committee is, why wouldn't you have this for all offenses? Why is it just sex offenses? Why isn't it burglaries, robberies, and whatnot? because of our history, because of our legal history. Up until the 60s and 70s of the last century, the courts would give an instruction that said a victim's character for chastity gives the jury some may give the jury some pause to say, you know, we shouldn't convict this guy. And that was in the 60s and 70s that those instructions were given. And that was the movement for this rape shield statute. That was the issue that came up. I think that either in Mr. Mittman's letter or in some of Mr. Steiner's testimony, there's been questions about this give notice. You have to give, right now the statute says you can do it in the middle of the trial. And that's just, you know, we've had a constitutional amendment since we did away with that jury instruction about a woman's character may be indicative of whether she consented to being raped or not. And that constitutional amendment said that victims are supposed to be treated with dignity and respect. It's not treating them fairly. I'm going to use my own words. It's not fair that a woman goes to a trial where she's a victim of a rape, and in the middle of that trial, this issue sprung on her. You know, well, you know, didn't you have sex with Bill 3 weeks earlier? That ought to be litigated beforehand. It ought not to be a surprise, and it ought to. We ought to look at our Constitution and say we're going to follow it in the statute that that victim of a sexual assault has an opportunity to prepare herself for what's coming if the court ultimately finds that it's relevant. And sometimes it could be relevant. And we're not saying that every instance is relevant or not relevant. And I'll tell you a case that I had when about a woman who was tied up and raped, duct tape raped. She was in her own apartment. The person came in, duct taped her. And we had an issue about whether some of her relationships with prior boyfriends would come in. And the judge made a good point. He said, these don't come in. But, you know, if there had been a boyfriend who said that he came, that was the way that they generally had sex, he would come in the middle of the night, surprise her, tie her up with duct tape, then it may be that it would come in. So this statute allows for where it's relevant, but it gets us away from, you know, the before the 1960s, you know, back to, that was a common law, you know, but that instruction went back for hundreds of years that juries used to get about the character of a rape victim.
Okay, proceed. Representative Millett.
So, Mrs. Spadi, I met with the Public Defender's Office, and one of the problems that they had with this is that if there was evidence that was relevant to the case on the public defender's side, that they wanted an in. They wanted an in at some point if it really changed the argument. And what had been suggested is that there would be something additional to this that would require, if there was additional evidence that came in during the trial and you didn't meet the 5-day requirement, that you could have the judge review it, and then the judge would make a determination if it was relevant to the case or not relevant to the case. Is that something that you guys have been discussing, or is that just defeat the purpose of the statute change?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, that's something that we can easily live with. What we don't want to have happen is the public defender or any defense lawyer sandbagging the victim. And if the information they've been sitting there for 4 months and they think, I'm going to get some tactical advantage by doing it in the middle of the trial, I want them to lose that advantage. But if, you know, I know Mr. Steiner's given this example of if the victim testifies about something that opens that door, I really find it difficult to imagine that a woman's going to, who's there in the middle of a rape trial, start talking about her boyfriend from 3 years ago. But I don't have a problem with it if it truly is a surprise, and it more likely would come up with some information that the state would provide the defense and their witness preparation or something like that. But I believe I heard a question of some discussion about whether CS from the other body would be used, and I think that we've already got that language worked out in that CS.
I guess if it's something that you've worked out through the CS on the other side, so it would be, there would be an exception. But my question back to the public defender was, how do you know if you didn't? How is it just an honor system that you didn't report it during the discovery phase, and then you just held off until the middle of the trial, and you knew that it was compelling enough that it would change the judge's perspective? How do you know when that evidence came into the possession of the public defender or the state? I mean, I guess that's my problem with it. Is it just an honor code, or if
through the chair? I think the answer to your question is generally it's the honor code. Prosecutors don't oftentimes question whether the defense didn't have it for a long time in the pair, and I'm sure that the defense questions was the state holding exculpatory evidence back? We, the state, have to provide any exculpatory evidence to the defense in a criminal case as a result of both of our rules of court and a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Discovery's a one-way street for the most part. They don't have to provide us the discovery. So when I say it's kind of an honor system, it would be, you know, you'd have to have the prosecution would have to have some reason to believe that they had the information and were sitting on it. And maybe we would. Maybe a witness would come and say, well, I told to us, and I told them all about this three months ago. And then we would say, well, wait a minute, you know, you're beyond the 5 day time that this statute sets. But for the most part, it's the honor. Yes, it's the honor code.
Thank you.
I guess I don't see, I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding why this wouldn't apply equally in any situation where it's a he said, she said, or he said, he said. I mean, for example, in an assault case that doesn't involve sexual assault at all, I mean, whether or not the victim has engaged in fights, a lot of those could be very, very relevant to whether that victim has been attacked and is, in fact, the victim, or whether the victim in fact actually is the person who started the whole thing in the first place. I guess so. I'm having a hard time understanding where this just applies to sexual assault cases as opposed to the whole gamut of things, other than that once upon a time there was a history of, but
the chair, Representative Ledoux, I am going to fall back on the history because I don't think there was a history in our law that if you had been victimized three times before, victim of a robbery, that somehow that came into a trial or a robbery once. If somebody came up and took your cash when you were at gunpoint, when you were withdrawing it from a cash machine. There's a rule of court, evidence rule 404A, that generally says propensity to be a victim or to be an offender is generally not admitted. Now, there is a lot of exceptions to that, and one of those exceptions for hundreds of years is if in a rape case You had sex with somebody who wasn't your husband, or you had sex with somebody who was, you know, 3 weeks before this, that you were a, quote, loose woman, unquote, loose woman, and end quote, and hence that may be some indication that you weren't raped. So I don't think we can get around. I mean, we have two rules. You know, we have a rule that said it was okay for rape victims. We've changed that, but we're trying to tighten that up. And we have a rule that says, evidence rule 404, that says, in general, propensity evidence is not admissible in civil or criminal trials.
Makes sense. What are we going to do?
So how long ago did the chastity instruction cease to exist?
The chair, I don't think it, there was a, I can't give you a date, but in the, it was being given in this state in the 50s and 60s, and in the early 70s, if you went to McCormick on evidence, the Horn book would talk about its admissibility. So, but I think by the 70s, generally, most courts came around to say, well, this is disfavored.
Okay.
So we're trying to correct something and tighten up something here for an instruction that hasn't basically been given in like about 35 years?
Well, through the chair, I think what we're really trying to do is give a victim of a sexual assault the opportunity to know that it's coming if the court's going to allow it in rather than being surprised in the middle of the trial.
Thank you.
Representative Hoover?
Probably when we deal with this, or maybe even today, people should be given a copy of Rule 404. It's a fairly complex rule. And there are a lot of cases on the subject, and it's just been litigated all over the place. But the general rule is, and this is character of the victim. There's another section on character of the accused, but character of the victim, and it says, evidence of a relevant trait of the character of the victim offered by the accused, blah, blah, blah. Is admissible, subject to the following procedure. Just a second. When the person seeking to admit the evidence for any purpose, the party must apply for an order of the court at any time before or during the trial or preliminary hearing. And then it talks about how they conduct a hearing outside the presence of the jury to make that determination. It's a question of the admissibility of evidence, so it goes to the judge, it doesn't go to the jury. And what this is doing here on page 8, line 15, requires in these kinds of cases that that you have to do this prior to 5 days before the trial. And the question really is, why are these cases so different from a policy point of view that there should be a specific exception to the normal rule in 404? And I would again ask Mr. Svobodny if he can justify that.
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, I go back to what I just said. I mean, these are, you know, if somebody holds me up at the ATM machine, I'm going to be scared. I may be mad. I may feel really nervous about going to trial, but no one's going to ask me about my sex life, you know, in that case. If it's a sexual assault, you know, I'm not walking in that person's shoes, but I think it's a hugely different problem for a victim of that type of crime than for when somebody takes money out of my house.
And if I may, in fact, this particular provision, that one phrase, not later than 5 days, rather than at any time before trial, if that would change Rule 404, shouldn't that have a section in the bill that says it's an indirect court rule amendment?
Through the chair, I think that's right.
I don't see anything in here that says that.
We've got something to work on. Did you have one more comment on this topic?
We just, I don't, what page are we on?
It's in the bill. The court rule changes in the bill. Is that what you're talking about? 404B, the last one was amended.
Oh, what page?
Oh, no, 23,
I'm sorry if I didn't catch.
Well, the question for the committee is to make sure that, look at the effect of what it has in court rule 404.
No, that's 404. And this is 404A.
Right.
That's a different rule.
That's one that a good catch, and we will consider it for our, Yes, so thanks. I'm not trying to turn it off, but I just, let's proceed. Representative Duke.
Well, Mr. Sabandi, if you're robbed or you are, somebody punches you, they assault you, nobody might be asking you about your sex life, but they might be asking you during the course of the trial, once they've gone to the judge and found that it is relevant, about every fight that you've ever been in which you may have assaulted somebody else. So I guess I just don't buy, because we historically had a very bad rule 35 years ago, or maybe my arithmetic is wrong, but quite a long time, probably before some of the members of this committee may even have been born, that it's necessary to change the general rule about admissibility of evidence for this one particular crime.
Through the chair, this changes the present rule in one way, that you have to give notice and you have to be heard if you know about it before 5 days before trial. It doesn't, I think I gave examples earlier where it could be relevant, a victim's prior sex life, and the judge has the discretion under the statute to do that. They have that today.
I understand that. It's just a matter of amending for one particular crime the normal course of when the character of the victim goes before a judge for a hearing.
Through the chair, that is correct, that it does it for sexual assault type crimes, and we don't do it for other type crimes.
And Representative Liu, that is the policy decision for us, right? So, thanks for pointing it out. Representative Miller?
Thank you. I agree, because I think that while you make a great case for equality, it gives the victim time to determine whether she wants to go forward, he or she wants to go forward in the charge of the sexual crime, balancing that against having her past brought up. I mean, it gives a victim opportunity to know what they're going to be facing, and maybe, some victims might not want to, would rather live with a crime and rather than live with their past history being exposed. I mean, it gives the victim, puts the power back into the victim's hands, where with assault and things like that, I mean, it's I guess, I understand the rape shield. I've seen it used, and I think it's important that we have that in place, and I think the time change is very important.
Well, we can continue this discussion on this policy decision, and again, it's very good. This is what we're exactly why we're doing this. So,
may I just say one thing,
Representative Bloomberg?
I appreciate your moving this forward. The There are two things that we also need to consider in this discussion. Number one, there's a provision in the criminal rules, just like in every other rule, that allows the court to relax the rules. And if you wanted to do it a little later, you could say, I realize this isn't permissible under the statute, which is an indirect court rule amendment, but under the rules which take precedence here, you can relax the rule. Wouldn't you say that the relaxation rule would still apply in something like this? Through the chair.
Through the chair, I'd want to think about this. I think that in general, if we fix the evidence rule 404A portion of this, the court should follow the statute that the legislature creates. I'm going to leave it at that. I think that needs to be more. I need to have more thought about whether a court could, by court rule that the legislature specifically changed, come back and say, well, we're going to relax these rules.
Mr. Chair, if I may, that is a tremendously important issue. It goes way beyond what we're dealing here with this little rule. The question is, when this legislature has changed a court rule by an indirect court rule amendment, the normal rule that allows the rules to be relaxed doesn't apply. And I'm surprised to hear Mr. Svobodny say that, because that turns the law of this state on its head, I'll bet. I can't believe that a court wouldn't apply that. And I would like to see if you have any precedent to the contrary. That's extremely important and very troubling to me. Secondly, if in fact that was the only impediment this 5-day, I would expect that if they admitted it, that the DA would ask for a continuance so that it would meet the 5 days. Wouldn't that also possibly occur?
Through the chair, I suspect that we would be saying, you don't get it in, and the defense would be arguing, well, let's just give me a 5-day continuance, and now we'll litigate it. I suppose that's less, I guess now we go back to the honor rules that Representative Millett was talking about. I mean, you know, if you find a way around the statute, maybe the court will allow it, maybe it won't.
These are incredibly important policy decisions. Affects the lives of so many on both ends of the scale, and I appreciate the work that's being done. Just to help me plan here, how far are you doing? The reason I'm asking is that I have a bill that I've been trying to squeak through here in the last 10 minutes for the last couple of weeks, and I'm willing to set that aside, but if I do, I want to tell my staff so they don't have to sit here. But yeah, how much, if we didn't interrupt, how much time is left? And then I'll double it, and then we'll see where we're at.
If there are no interruptions, 5 minutes.
Okay, well. Shoot. Well, we'll try it then. Go.
I
didn't
know what it would work. I have two left, so I'll deal with the easiest one. In my view, is the easiest one. Section 36 of the bill was raised in the last committee meeting, and that's a provision dealing with child protection in Title 47. That is, when a child's been removed from a home, the general rule is that that health and social services needs to do whatever they can to reunite that family. And there's a list of exceptions when they don't have to do this. And that now would, under this provision, say that they don't have to make those extraordinary efforts if the person is a convicted sex offender. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't try to reunite the home, but they don't have to prove by clear and convincing evidence everything that they did to try to reunite that home. Lots of times these offenders are in jail. I had a secretary for many years who was in a battle over custody where she was adopting children, and the person was a sex offender, and he was serving a 25-year sentence. It changes the burden that everybody looks at about what you have to do for reuniting, well, the efforts that you have to put in for reuniting a family before parental rights can be terminated, and in my example, the secretary adopt the three children. That,
I have a question. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm
sure,
so sorry.
No,
this is the one that I had the biggest problem. Not the, thank you. That I had a problem with, because it only applies to the parent or guardian. Doesn't apply if there's another sex offender living in the home. And that was my question to Ms. Carpinetti, was while we take into consideration the parent or the guardian being the sex offender, if there's another person in the home that's a registered sex offender that's part of the family unit, we don't take that into consideration. So I can give you examples of children. Let's just say the guardian is a grandparent, and the grandparent has a child, one of their kids living with them that's an older child that's a sex offender, and they're the guardian of the grandchild, and they are trying to reunite that child with the grandparent, but they're still going to be living with a registered sex offender because of that home. How does that work? How can you, by nature, that sex offender can't be near, part of the probation can't be living with a child, but you're setting up pick or choose.
Yeah. Through the chair, I have two answers to that. There's the one that's not very helpful, but it's the one that caused the language to be put in there, and that is now, as I understand it, for federal aid that's required, not necessarily that language, but that presumption that you're going to put these all the efforts you can into reuniting the family goes away if the person's a sex offender. That's not the very good answer. Better answer, I think, is that we should look at this, see if it needs to be broadened or left as is. I'd have to work my way through all the examples that could arise. Specifically, in the example that you gave, there is a criminal offense for endangering the welfare of a minor where you allow a sex offender to reside in your home. The problem with that statute is that it punishes people if the sex offender reoffends against the child, and I don't want to be reactive. I want to be proactive in protecting those kids. But I will talk to Ms. Carpinetti, and we'll look at that. The bad answer, I don't think, stops us from addressing your concerns. I'd like to try the last one, Mr. Chairman, unless you really press for time.
Again, I do not want to hurry this. I'm not trying to, but I was just trying to point out. Representative Greenberg.
A question to the chair. I do have a few questions here, one or two. Would you prefer that I wait till the next time and let him finish today?
No, if, I can be patient with my bill. I have been, and I don't see it as a real big deal. So please proceed while we're talking about it, while these thoughts are in our minds, so we don't have to spend the time to refresh later. So as a question to this point, yes, go ahead, please.
This deals with the fact that, as I understand it, the statute that we're dealing with in Section 36 just deals with whether, quote, reasonable efforts should be required or not, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Sorry, Chair.
And the in this state, as I recall, there are many things that you have to register for if you've been convicted as a sex offender. They're not all assaults or things like that. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, there are many of the sex almost all the sex offenses and kidnapping you have to register for. Not murder, not theft, not arson.
No, but like public urination in the woods or something. You have to register for that?
Through the chair, the only requirement, the with one exception, and it's not urinating in the woods, all the offenses for which you have to register are felony-level offenses. I think it is indecent exposure a second time is the misdemeanor offense that you have to register for. So that's the only exception.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to try this one. It's a complicated area, but I'm going to speak fast. This is
relax and go and take time.
I appreciate that, but this is section 14, 15, 43, and 44, and it's immunity. And this deals with the constitutional right not to incriminate yourself. That is, we don't have pan forte dur, which was what they did in old common law. I know some people don't like history, but they put a board on you and pile rocks on you till you talked. We don't have that. We don't have somebody who can be forced to testify in court against themselves. But throughout our history, we've had an exception to that, and that is when the person's been given immunity from criminal prosecution for their testimony. They aren't going to be incriminating themselves. They've been given a get-out-of-jail free card. These portions of the immunity can be divided into two parts. One is the process that exists now versus what it should be, and the process now allows for a lawyer. Don't need to have the person there at all. A lawyer come in and said, "Well, this is what my client might have a Fifth Amendment privilege," and the judge makes a decision whether they have to testify or not. This changes that to require the person claiming the privilege to set out under oath the facts that allow the lawyer to say that they have a First Amendment privilege, and the judge to make a record of that in writing. That record is sealed. I mean, it is not available to the public or the parties. So it stops the lawyer. It requires now, this bill change, law change, would require the victim to actually show up in court. Excuse me, I misspoke. The person claiming the Fifth Amendment privilege to actually show up in court and set forth under oath the facts sufficient for a judge to make a finding whether or not they have a Fifth Amendment privilege. Why is that necessary? Kind of gets to the other part of this. The bill also would give the state the right to appeal a decision made by the court about whether the person has a Fifth Amendment privilege. And why is that important? It's because if you have a judge finds that you have a Fifth Amendment privilege, our existing law allows the Attorney General to grant that person immunity. And in this state, we have what's called transactional immunity. It's anything you testify about, you got to get out of jail free card. That is not the general rule across the country. The general rule is you get use immunity, that anything you testify about you can't be used in an upcoming trial or a trial of you. Transactional immunity is you can't get tried. Okay? So that's not so much of a problem. The problem arises when the judge on his or her own, I mean by themselves, this is done in private, makes a determination that the witness has immunity. The judge then communicates with the Attorney General and says to the Attorney General, "I find that there is a Fifth Amendment privilege here." That's not such a big deal to us. I mean, we don't necessarily want to appeal that decision because we have a choice at that point. We can make a determination to grant the person the get-out-of-jail-free card, transactional immunity, or say, no, we aren't going to give this person immunity. Okay? So that's the background to the next part of this. The next part is two cases the Alaska our Alaska courts have said in a case called Eccles, and then Cogdill, that you know, if the state's kind of messing around with this, if they're kind of manipulating who gets to testify and who doesn't, then the court can say to the state, you grant immunity here, or I'm going to dismiss this case. Not the case against the witness, case against that you're in trial with. And they make that determination by assessing the witnesses, what the witness says, and whether that will materially affect the outcome of that other trial. So, here's the position, and I was in this position this last summer, and it is the hardest decision I've made, I think, as a lawyer, and when I've been in positions where I have been the Attorney General's designee and had to make them in other cases, they've always been some of the most difficult decisions. But the decision I was faced last summer, murder case in Palmer, a witness testifies, called by the state, examined by the state, cross-examined by the defense, leaves the witness stand. She had testified that she had misled the defendant in the case had a knife, and that she had misled the police and didn't tell them about it, and actually told them she hadn't found it, and she had found it and given it to somebody else. Her lawyer and her go back. The defense said, well, later on in the trial, we're going to call her. So this isn't a state witness, defense witness. Called into, they go into the judge's chambers. The judge, my recollection is, first said she has no Fifth Amendment privilege. They go back in another time. The witness and her lawyer, judge says she's got a Fifth Amendment privilege. What is the state going to do?
I'm sorry, your voice dropped off.
Went back in a second time. Now she does. Some new information was presumably given to the judge. We don't know that. We don't know this, but we assume because we're not there. It's a Fifth Amendment privilege. If we're there, you know, the courts made her give up that privilege, and it's really only the Attorney General in the state who can do that. Third day, goes back, the lawyer goes back without the witness, and judge comes out and says, this is I've been given more new information, and now I find under this Eccles and Cogdill case that if the state won't grant this woman immunity, I'm going to dismiss this case. So I got a choice. You know, the answer may be that she was also part of the murder, and I've just given her a get out of jail free card, or it may be that, you know, she stole a $20 bottle of booze from the crime scene. I have no idea knowing. And we were able to appeal that, petition that. We don't have a right to appeal. But that's where we want to be. Have the right to appeal. When it's down to making the decisions where the court's saying, I'm going to dismiss your murder case, or I'm going to dismiss any case because of something that the state has no control over, that's when that judge's decision should be reviewed in my mind. Now, I know that in the letter from the ACLU, they said, well, we can't imagine how the state would do this. They're not supposed to know anything. And that's exactly right. They're right. It's an Alice in Wonderland appeal. But, you know, I gave you facts that we were able to go to the Court of Appeals on. They agreed to take it. They said no Fifth Amendment privilege here, no indication that the state, remember one of the tests is did the kind of the state manipulate this person? No indication of that. And then the witness petitions
the Supreme Court, and they say, we think the trial judge is the best person to make that decision. I ended up granting her immunity, and she testified exactly the same the second time. I don't know what went on in that courtroom with the judge. I don't care. But I didn't sleep for 3 days till, you know, I may have, it was, you know, it's an impossible, this, I think it's an impossible burden on the Attorney General. Frankly, I'd like to be able to pawn it off on the appellate court. that's not, I was being flippant there. But I think that it is deserving of review by an appellate court. I know Mr. Steiner said, the information may come out. Well, that's true. I mean, the judge could have walked out of this courtroom and said something that he shouldn't have said. Somebody could have broken into his office if he recorded it. I believe from the Court of Appeals decision that he actually did record it because they reviewed it. But there's really nothing to say that they have to do that either, except this change would say, you got to put it in writing now. Explain your rationale so the appellate courts will understand. It is to try to correct what Mr. Mittman called an incredible, you know, it would be incredible to believe that people would have to go through an appellate process where they didn't know the facts. We're not going to know any more facts. We just want the ability to go through that kind of incredible process.
That's really helpful. Reverend, we'll do.
I've got a couple of questions, if that's okay. First of all, how did you get it before the appellate court? Did you get it on a petition for review and what you're asking for right now? A petition, of course, is discretionary, and an appeal would not be discretionary. Is that the big thing that you're...
Through the chair, that's exactly right.
Okay. And then I've got a second question. I can see the problem, and I can see why you'd want the right of appeal, and that makes sense. I feel real uncomfortable considering that the right to avoid self-incrimination goes back to the founding fathers of this country. I mean, that's like really embedded there. Why you couldn't have everything you want and just have it on a lawyer's proof of evidence?
Offer of proof.
Thank you, Representative.
I didn't want to go down this road.
Sorry.
But through another case, it's come to our attention that the defense lawyers often get together and decide this is a strategy. We, this summer, deposed several lawyers in the community, which I won't name. Where it was disclosed that it was the practice in that community, especially in domestic violence cases, that when you were representing the defendant, you got on the phone. You walked down to the hall and talked to people who were renting space from you or somebody else that you worked closely with and said, will you represent the victim in this case? And then let's talk about whether your victim's got a Fifth Amendment privilege. In the particular case that I just described, the state didn't know any of the facts, but the opposition to our petition for review set out some facts that could have only come from either the judge, and the judge, I think, was scrupulous and not giving one side facts and not the other. He would come into court and say, I think this is bizarre. I can't tell you guys why I'm doing this. But that could have only come from somebody in that room, and that could have been the witness or it could have been a lawyer.
I guess if you think that the defense bar is doing something illegal or unethical, it would seem that it would be appropriate to lodge a bar complaint, file charges or something like that, as opposed to almost obliterating the Fifth Amendment.
Through the chair, I don't want to
change the Fifth Amendment at all. So I don't want to obliterate it. As you know, there are rules about what you can or can't say that are pending before the bar if there's a bar complaint.
Representative Greenberg?
This is going to require some thought on my part, so I'm just kind of off the top of my head. What you're really saying, it sounds like, is that you, the state, want the right to take an interlocutory appeal, even though it's not a final appealable order. And you don't want to have to wait until the close of the case and either take an appeal at that point or a cross appeal if the defense appeals. Am I correct?
Through the chair, that's absolutely right. If we can't wait, I have to grant immunity or not grant immunity, the judge has to dismiss the case or not dismiss it. And if he does, you know,
if in fact it sounds like that you're concerned if you do grant the immunity, you can't unring the bell because everything will have been done and you couldn't then retry the person. Or could you? I don't know.
Through the chair, I can't unring the bell twice. I can't unring the bell if we granted the person immunity and they were culpable. If I don't grant immunity under the circumstances where, and this is where I want to be able to appeal, where the judge says, I'm going to dismiss your murder case or your rape case unless you grant immunity, and I say no, then that person walks.
May I? Can't you take a Cooksey, analogize it to a Cooksey situation? A Cooksey situation, I think that's right, is you plead guilty, but you reserve a point of law on the appeal.
Through the chair. If you were the defendant, if I were the defendant, why would I do that? The state's got to dismiss my case, and I'm free.
I'm lost. I'm going to have to go. This is very complex.
It is complex, very complex.
If the trial hasn't started already, if the judge dismissed the case, you could take it up on appeal because that wouldn't be a violation of the, I can't remember what amendment it is, but the right to not be tried more than once. Is that correct?
Through the chair. That's right. Until the jeopardy doesn't attach, until the jury's sworn. Yeah.
But can I follow up?
So if the jury's
sworn already, even if it's just at the very beginning of things, if the judge dismisses the case, it's it.
Yeah. Through the chair. That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, what we're going to do, thank you so much for coming. And
sorry, Mr. Chairman.
No, don't apologize.
I said without questions I could do it.
Well, that's all right. We'll just blame Representative Greenberg. He's got broad shoulders, right? That was a tempty humor.
You ain't seen nothing. There's one of me in it.
I'm going to have to take credit for some of the slowdown, too, I think.
I'll take some, too. On Wednesday, we're having a joint meeting, and we're going to hear a report by the Task Force on Sex Trafficking. Keep in mind that starts at 1:30 instead of 1 like we normally meet, and it'll be down in room 106 because it's a little bigger. And then on Friday, we're not having a meeting, and then on Monday when we get back, now we've got a docket of 3 bills, you know, that have been previously heard, and I would appreciate it very much if you would look at HB 1 and HB 83, and if you have questions, try to resolve them as much as you can. I mean, things that aren't committee work. And HB 73, I'm not going to say we're going to be on that on Monday, but we'll talk about that inside. Representative Greenberg.
Mr. Chair, I talked to you about this. I want to let the other folks know what we've talked about. On the governor's bill here, the Senate is farther along than we are in this, and they have the Senate version, the Senate, what is it, the new version, And if the chair...
Representative Wilbert, you made that point, and that's good. It's under consideration, but we cannot adopt a Senate bill.
No, I would also,
so we would have to bring it over here, and we would have to get it redrafted as a...
I could say this would be the text of the proposed CS.
And make an amendment or something.
Yeah.
Cover the whole thing. Yeah, like I say, we'll look at it.
Just
thank you.
But I'm
here
at time.
Thank you again, Rick. And so with that, we're going to adjourn. Hey, we made it. Look at that. Second hands right on top. 3 o'clock.